Good afternoon, New York, and the rest of our listeners around the globe. My name is June Stoyer, and I'm the host of the Organic Bee Radio Show. Our podcast is available on iTunes, Zune, and you can also visit our website at www.theorganicbee.com. If you have any questions for our guests, there are many ways you can contact the show. You can post a question on our wall on Facebook, Skype us, send us a tweet on Twitter to @TheOrganicView, or you can contact me directly at June Stoyer. If you'd like to be on the show or would like to find out about sponsorship opportunities, please contact us at questions@TheOrganicView.com. Today's show is brought to you by LiquidWeb.com, the most reliable hosting provider with 24/7 heroic support. Listeners of today's show will receive $100 credit towards Storm servers, which includes virtual private servers and dedicated hosting. Or you can try LiquidWeb's shared hosting for free for 1 month by using the coupon code ORGVIEW. That's ORGVIEW. Please visit LiquidWeb.com and make sure that you tell them that you found out about them on the show. Today's topic, how you can sustain wildlife with native plants. Biodiversity is something that clearly affects all species. Everything is connected to each other, regardless of whether or not it is on a large or small scale. Sometimes the way we garden can actually improve our landscape, and at times can be disastrous, such as the case with the introduction of invasive species such as kudzu, purple loosestrife, etc. Nevertheless, there are choices we can make that can positively impact our landscape according to the plants we select and what we introduce into the landscape. Our choices not only affect our view of the land, but can also impact animals, insects, and microorganisms that are dependent upon the role of such plants. In essence, human beings have the power to sustain life or destroy it because of these choices. On today's show, I have the pleasure of welcoming Dr. Douglas Palamy, and we're going to be talking about his magnificent book called Bringing Nature Home, which explores the impact of our choices and what we can do to sustain wildlife in our own backyard. So I would like to welcome to the show Dr. Douglas Palamy. Good afternoon, Professor Palamy, and welcome to The Organic View.
Thank you, June. Pleasure to be here.
It is a pleasure to finally have you on the show. I have heard so many wonderful things about you, about my good friend John Peter Thompson, who's an invasive species expert who's been on the show several times, and he cannot say enough wonderful things about you. And he told me, he said, June, when you get a copy of this book, you are not going to put it down, and this is going to be a book that you're going to tote with you, especially when you go to different horticultural hotline workshops and whatnot, or not workshops, but when you're working with the public and doing all sorts of stuff, because it's just such a great reference book, and not to mention the fact that the pictures are just absolutely fantastic.
Well, and I appreciate all those kind words.
Well, I took the book actually in my backyard, and it was just amazing how much you learn just by looking at all the different species that you reference and just seeing what you can find in your own yard. And I think it's also a great tool for teachers if they want to help children understand how everything is connected.
That's a really important point, because our yards are the first place that our children are introduced to nature. And they can either be introduced to a lot of nature, to interesting things, or very little nature, or they can be taught to fear nature, and that's happening an awful lot these days.
Yeah, it's a shame. I think that has to do with the fact that the way our food is presented to us, it's basically stripped of the feathers, stripped of any anything to do with its origin. I mean, everything is packaged. It's breaded. It's got all sorts of coatings and dressings and all sorts of stuff, and for that very reason, people have just really become disconnected with nature. And I think if they were more connected, especially with the food that they eat, and if they saw that, you know, apples are not necessarily, you know, this perfectly shaped fruit, but they have all sorts of flaws, because that's, you know, what happens in nature, that it would help to just reinforce the fact that nature is not something that comes in a particular package and is always consistent as far as size, color, texture, so on and so forth. And
I think it's also not optional. We absolutely need nature. We need all those living things out there because those are the things that run the ecosystems, that produce the ecosystem services that keep humans alive and happy. And if we sterilize our living environments to the point where nature is essentially gone, then our children, who are the future stewards of the planet, won't miss it when it disappears. They'll miss it eventually, but they don't realize that when they look out of their window and they see nothing, that's not normal. That's not right. They think that is normal because it's the only thing they've ever experienced. So it's really important that we put nature back in their lives, not just to bond them to the natural world, but because we have developed so much of the physical area of the U.S. and the world in general. We can't afford to take those systems, all that area, out of the production of ecosystem services. There's not enough natural areas left to produce all of those things that keep our ecosystems going. So we need to start thinking about our yards, our gardens, as places to produce oxygen, to produce clean water, to sequester carbon dioxide, to support food webs that produce that support all of the animals that are out there. All these things can happen right in our yards if we remember what plants do.
Oh, I completely agree. And that's, I guess, why it's so important for people to have that constant reminder of how everything plays its part, you know. Dr. Talamy, can you tell our audience about yourself and also the work, the research that you've been involved with so that our audience can become more familiar with you?
Okay, well, I'm an entomologist at the University of Delaware. I've been here 30 years, and I have studied, among many other things, how insects interact with plants that are on this planet. You know, most people don't like insects very much, and they just as soon not think about what insects are doing. And we tend to think of plants only in terms of their ornamental value. You know, they're ornaments that decorate our landscapes. And, of course, we don't want insects eating our ornaments. But plants do all those things I just talked about. They're the basis of every food web. It's plants that capture the energy from the sun and turn it into, turn the energy into simple sugars and carbohydrates. The energy from the sun is then locked up in the carbon bonds of simple sugars and carbohydrates, which are the basis of all the food webs on the planet, except for some minor ones at the bottom of the ocean. So plants, in essence, are allowing us and everything else to eat sunlight. And if we only think of them in terms of their ornamental value, we're taking a huge risk here. Unfortunately, all plants are not equal in their ability to support food webs, and that's what my research has been showing. It turns out that particularly insects are very sensitive to which plants they are able to eat. They're able to eat the ones that they have developed adaptations for, and this is all because plants don't want to be eaten. Plants want to protect that energy that they've locked up in their tissues, and so they load their leaves with nasty-tasting chemicals. We call them secondary metabolic compounds. And that makes most plants unpalatable to most of the herbivores that are out there. And if you don't believe me, just walk outside and grab a leaf of anything and eat it. You'll find it doesn't taste very good. So most insects cannot eat most plants. How do insects eat plants? Well, they become a specialist on a particular type of chemical defense, and they develop the enzymes and the physiological adaptations that allow them to circumvent that, get around that defense. And the life history is they come out at the right time of year, and they eat the plant in a certain way so that they can eat that particular plant without being poisoned. That's called specialization, and I always use the monarch butterfly as a perfect example.
Yeah.
Because it's a specialist on milkweeds. It only eats milkweeds, and what it's really specialized on is the cardiac glycosides. Those are the chemicals that are defending milkweeds. So actually, when you're running outside and eating plants, don't eat a milkweed, because if you eat enough milkweed or enough cardiac glycosides, it'll stop your heart. We don't want that.
No.
But of course, monarchs are able to eat them without any problem, and that's the good part about specializing. The downside about specializing is that now that's all that monarchs can eat.
Yeah.
So if we remove milkweeds from our landscape because we want lawn or we want violets or something else, the monarch cannot eat lawn or violets or oak trees or anything else, and they'll disappear.
And it's really tough because milkweeds tend to take over.
Well, you can find a certain part of your yard where you can have a nice little milkweed patch and support those monarchs. But remember, that's one species of insect herbivore, and we have many thousands in this country. 90% of them are specialists, just like that monarch. So if we landscape in a way that eliminates the plant communities, the native plant communities that support those insects, we're going to lose 90% of our insect herbivores. And the problem with that is that so many other things eat insects that we can't afford to lose them, or the entire food web, terrestrial food web, will collapse. So for example, everybody likes birds. Well, 96% of our terrestrial birds rear their young on insects. Or the book will say insects and other arthropods, and the other arthropods are spiders, which ate insects to become spiders. So no matter how you slice it, if you take the insects away, you're taking away the food for all of our baby birds, or 96% of them. And, you know, if people look at it that way, then they say, well, they get it. They say, we really do need insects. And, of course, birds are just one group. There are many mammals that need insects. The entire food web is depending on insects to gather energy from the plant and pass it on. And that's the problem. We have landscaped in a way that makes it very tough on our local insects. Most of our ornamental plants come from someplace else. Many of them come from Asia, and most of them are very poor at supporting our local insects because our insects haven't had a chance to build up those adaptations to specialize on those particular plants. So if we landscape with a crepe myrtle, for example, you look at those crepe myrtle leaves, nothing is eaten out of those because nothing can eat those plants. Actually, there's three species of caterpillars recorded from it. But compare that to an oak tree where there's 534 species recorded. If you wanna put a plant in your yard that acts like a bird feeder, put an oak tree out there because that's exactly what it's doing. It's making bird food. I'm just taking a break. Yeah, I can keep talking if you want.
No. I'm just thinking about how many different plants that are out there that you don't really think about the interaction between the plants that are there, their role, what species feed off of these plants, and if they happen to take over, how many species will be, well, we'll have to find other homes.
Right.
But also, what happens when you have one particular dominant species that has taken over something that, something else? And if you look at the animal kingdom, this is something that I know that a lot of scientists have been working on as far as predators that are essential to an ecosystem, because
right.
People think that predators are bad, because basically Hollywood has taught us that, and we're groomed to think that they're bad because of, you know, everything from our parents to all sorts of different references that say that predators are bad. They're the enemy. And the thing is that there was a film called The Lords of Nature, in which they show what happens when you remove a necessary predator.
Right.
Other species basically take over, and what they do is they wipe out the landscape. There are certain trees that will no longer be able to grow because that's the source of food, and in essence, so many different habitats are destroyed. So when you look at that from that perspective, and then you apply it to, you know, you take a closer look, which is what you've done, and you're saying, okay, well, you're looking at certain plants that have dominating traits, and when they take over, look at how this affects so many different microorganisms, and in essence, even macroorganisms.
And when we look at the plants that are taking over, we call them invasive species.
Mm.
85% of our woody invasive species are escapees from our garden. We have brought them in as ornamentals, and then they stay in our garden, but they move into our natural areas as well. So 85% of them, it's almost every woody invasive species you can think of was once brought in by the horticultural trade. And now 30% of the plant biomass in our natural areas is from Asia, not supporting the food webs that we need them to support. So our little parks and preserves are supposed to be keeping our native species around, but they're doing a poor job for two reasons. They're too small, and 30% of their plants aren't doing the job they're supposed to do because they didn't evolve here. So there's a tremendous cost when we select a plant from Asia and put it into our yard. And it comes as a huge surprise to people to realize that their little property does have really important ecological value and plays in extremely important ecological roles. We did a survey, I guess it was two summers ago, looking at what our suburban landscapes look like in terms of the plants that are in them. And it was a pretty big sample size, but the result is that 92% of the landscapable area turned out to be lawn. So 92% is lawn where there are very few plants at all. I mean, lawn is it's very close to paving over the landscape. Most of the plants have been removed. 79% of the plants that are in that landscape are introduced. They're from someplace else. So here we have a barren landscape with lawn and very few plants in it, but the plants that are there are from someplace else. We also looked at the amount of tree biomass, so just comparing the amount of trees in a suburban an average suburban yard with what would be found in a local woodlot, and it was only 10% of the trees. So we have removed 90% of the tree biomass. That's a pretty stark landscape, and if it's comprised largely of plants from someplace else, then it's no wonder that our animals are struggling. There's very little left to eat out there in our suburban neighborhoods.
Now, one of the buzzwords, if you will, that many people tend to throw around is the word biodiversity and also the word sustainability.
Right.
Can you please give your definition of both words?
Okay, there are actually a lot of definitions of biodiversity. It's really a measure of the different life forms on Earth, but you can measure it in several different ways. You can talk about genetic diversity, or you can talk about population diversity or community diversity. Most people think of biodiversity in terms of species diversity, so simply count up the number of species in an area and say, that is the biodiversity in your particular area. And that's a fine definition. Sustainability if you think about what the word means it is going to stay in its current state essentially forever. Economists tend to think of sustainability in five-year intervals, but if we're talking about sustaining life on Earth and building sustainable ecosystems and sustainable landscapes, we're not talking about for 5 years, we're talking about forever, or at least an ecological time. And right now I'm going to argue that our yards, our neighborhoods are not landscaped in a sustainable way because they are not supporting nearly the amount of life that they used to. And if you reduce the amount of life in a particular area, that makes food webs very unstable, it makes ecosystems very unstable, and I get back to those ecosystem services. Our landscapes are no longer producing the ecosystem services that we humans need. Every time we add an additional human to the planet, we need more plants making more ecosystem services, not fewer. So if you picture Manhattan, where almost all the plants have been removed, and everybody's thriving there, and it looks like it's a great ecosystem, it's actually a completely dead ecosystem, and the only reason people can live there is because we are bringing in ecosystem services from someplace else.
Oh, of course, yeah.
So if you can't do that everywhere. You've got to have healthy ecosystems someplace else to provide the oxygen and the food and the water and remove the garbage and all the other things that happen on Manhattan Island. So the plan of growing forever and developing forever is not a good one because the planet has not grown the last time I looked.
No, it has not. But the thing is that with the continued continuous continued use of especially systemic pesticides, how do you think that these pesticides affect not only the plant life, but all the species that are dependent upon those very plants that are being affected by these agrochemicals?
Yeah, it's a big question because it depends on where we're using those pesticides. We've really boxed ourselves in the corner in terms of growing a population that is way above the ability of small little farm lots to support them. We need these giant mega farms, and we need to grow plants in giant monocultures. And of course, that's a wonderful situation for a pest because then they have endless food. So how do you control them? Well, everybody turns to chemicals. And to back away from that at this point is going to be very tough. It's all based on all of the energy input from fossil fuel industry, and if that were to disappear, mega agriculture would also disappear, and I just don't see how there'd be enough food for the 7 billion people we have on this planet. There are things that we do with our pesticides that we do not need to do, and I'll go back to our suburban lawns. Our lawns are status symbols, and the bigger they are, it's a sign that we're wealthier. And the greener they are, it's a sign that we have high status and we're good citizens because we put on our fertilizer and we put on our herbicides to kill the dandelions and so on and kill the chinch bugs. So in order to create this artificial carpet of green, we have a lot of chemical inputs. Then it rains. And most of them wash off. When you have a hot, dry summer, as we're having just about everywhere, the ground gets baked and lawns become highly impervious, 50 to 75% impervious. So if you get a big rain after you put down that fertilizer, most of it washes off into your nearest stream, and now it's in the waterway. So we wonder why the Chesapeake Bay is dead, because we've lined it with lawns. We've lost, I forget the figure, something like 100 acres of forest a day from the Chesapeake Bay watershed since, 1985 or something. It's an incredible figure. And replace that, of course, with all of these managed ecosystems that are using all the pesticides. And it's just not for a good reason, so that we can have really green lawns. I don't know. I don't want to get rid of lawns. I want to shrink them to the point where we have them where we walk. Lawn is the perfect plant to walk on without killing it. So look at your yard and decide, where do I walk? And mark out your little lawn areas and your lawn paths and move yourself around your property. And then everything else should become heavily planted with native plant communities that are attractive but are supporting an awful lot of animals. What we're doing when we do that is building biological corridors right through suburbia that connect the isolated habitat patches at each end of the street. And that will allow the populations in those isolated patches to thrive. Tiny populations don't. They fluctuate and eventually disappear. So if you connect those habitat patches, then the populations aren't tiny anymore. And the only way we can connect them is through our managed ecosystems, our neighborhoods and our corporate landscapes. And even our agricultural fields. We can't afford to shrink agriculture, but we can certainly treat the land better than we do.
Now, just out of curiosity, on that note, considering how much pollution we create because of our obsessive compulsion with lawns and lawn care, just out of curiosity, what is your thought on the landscape when it comes to the fracking process? I had to ask.
Yeah.
I just had Dr. Sandra Steingraber on last Friday, and this is something that is a very big, heated debate here in New York, not to mention many other parts of the world where people have seen what it does to the landscape as well as their groundwater.
Right. I live in Pennsylvania. I know about fracking. But We have a society that is built on fossil fuels. We have dragged our feet in terms of finding alternative energy sources, so much so that now it is other countries that are way ahead of us in that regard. And when it comes to really switching over to these sources, we're going to have to buy the technology from China and Japan and Germany and all these other places, because we've continued to rely so heavily on fossil fuels. So oil, oil's expensive, and all of a sudden we find a technology that allows us to get to the gas that is below our ground, and so we go nuts. We just do it immediately, and it's broad. I heard a figure this morning, I don't know, $13 billion or something to Pennsylvania already, and of course these economies need that money, so you know all the pressures that are forcing us to do that. But as happens so often, we are doing it quickly and without the proper approaches, or at least looking at how can we do this with minimal environmental impact. Even if there was no problem with our water, which I know there are problems, but even if there were not, we're taking these habitat fragments that are out there and further fragmenting them. Every single road that goes into to a fracking center is another fragment. So all over the place in their natural areas, all of this is happening in our state lands and all the places that you know were remaining wildlife areas are now loaded with gas pipes. From here, I mean, you fly over the Rockies these days and you look down, you can see it from whatever altitude. You can see it all over the place. So we're doing that. I think 50 years from now, we're going to be pretty sad that we did all that.
Well, if they turn the United States into a toxic waste dump, which,
yeah.
I mean, some of the comments that are coming out of our friends across the pond are not really too nice when it comes to the practices that we've implemented here and how we farm our lands, how we care for the environment. And it's almost disgraceful that you have countries like France that are the first to jump on top of something and say, absolutely not, we will not allow this on our land, but we seem to be the slowpokes where we have to have enough lawsuits and deaths
right.
in order to take action.
Right.
And I think that's a travesty.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is that with these ecosystems that would be destroyed by fracking, as you said, it would be one thing if the process or processes were thought out and everything had been fully tested, from start to finish. But it's almost as if, yeah, let's do it. Seems like a good idea. Some people are going to make tons of money. Of course, people are going to make a lot of money. And it's not necessarily the people that think that they're going to make the money. It's basically, the corporations that are trying to gain access to the land. The environmental disaster that's at hand is a huge concern because the people that own the land don't have the money to clean it up.
Right, for sure. You know, it's just another sign that we do not believe deep in our hearts, and certainly we don't believe it in our political hearts, that we need functioning ecosystems. We think we can abuse them, to the nth degree, because having that gas now is more important than maintaining functioning ecosystems. And of course, the gas pays off right now. So economically, any economic model would say, "Yep, get immediate money up front, and we'll deal with the consequences down the road." But you can only kick that can down the road so far before we're going to be very, very sorry about that.
It's it's something that I think people who are educated and understand what the ramifications are, they get it. And unfortunately, there are others that unless this happens in their own backyard, that's when they'll start to pay attention to it.
Right.
It's very easy to say, yeah, I want this, I want that, but when it happens in your own backyard, then what?
Well, it's interesting in New York because the Catskills are one of those places that supply ecosystem services for New York City. That's where they get their water. If we go do fracking in the Catskills and mess up New York City's water supply, there's going to be a problem. and it'd be a lot of people want to know why we did that. So,
well, I think especially not just the water, but the air.
Well, that's the other crazy thing. We're supposed to be concerned about climate change here, and yet we're doing everything we can to get that last bit of fossil fuel out of the ground and into the air. We have successfully mounted a huge public campaign to confuse the public about the importance of this issue. For the last 20 years, it's been enormously successful, so that even today, we're doing absolutely nothing about it. And almost everybody who's alive on the planet today is going to look back in the very near future and say, what were we thinking?
Well, it's interesting. The state of New Jersey had tremendous problems 20, 30 years ago with all of the waste that was being dumped haphazardly. And now the state is pretty aggressive as far as the waste management. And it's a shame that it had to go through that whole transition in order to be as aggressive as they are today. I mean, I just think it's kind of ridiculous that in the state of New Jersey, you are not allowed to pump your own gas by law. But in New York, you know, go for it. And the thing is that the emissions that are generated by the gasoline are really very bad for you. But yet, you know, once again, we don't have those laws in place. And the kicker is gasoline in New Jersey is usually 20 cents cheaper than in New York.
That's
kind of the irony of everything. I mean, you go to other states, and it just does not make sense. But I think it's a shame that we have to get to the point where things are just about nearly completely destroyed in order for action to take place.
Well, we're a reactive species and not a proactive one. Just in our makeup.
Now, with the pollution that has gone on from the fracking, I mean, is there anything that really can be done to restore the ecosystem in areas that have already been affected?
We're getting pretty far outside my area of expertise, but because fracking is new, and you know, if you chop the trees down, you gotta allow them to grow back. But something else that's much more apparent, of course, is the mountaintop removal for coal in West Virginia, where they take a mountain with a forest on it, and they essentially bulldoze the whole thing. And then when they're through, they replant a grassland on subsoil there's no topsoil left or anything, and then say, well, we've restored it. So you replaced a forest with a grassland that was going to struggle for decades trying to rebuild topsoil. So is that a restoration from getting all that coal out of the ground? I certainly not in terms of keeping the species that used to be there.
No, it's kind of like wiping out a garden area and then putting up potted plants that are, the cheapest plants possible, some of them even being plastic, just to say that, oh, yeah, here's your garden. Now you have your little vision of beauty that you can enjoy, and it's really not the same. But just out of curiosity, when it comes to working in an area where there has been devastation, and say if a homeowner, for example, wishes to try to do this on their own, where they will find out what the native plants are for that particular area, how long of a process is that, and is it possible for a homeowner to restore the land?
It is, and I can tell you that from personal experience, because that's exactly what we've been doing at our house. We moved into our house 10 years ago. I guess it's 11 years this summer. And the area, you know, it's been farmed for almost 400 years and very little topsoil left. And recently before we moved in, it was mowed for hay. So, you know, the forests are gone and very little life there. But we have worked, and we're talking about 10 acres, and we have put several hundred trees back. Now, none of them are huge 300-year-old trees, but at this point, after 10 years, they are, you know, 10, 15, some of them even 20 feet tall, and they are rebuilding the soil. And I can, You know, I know the insects that ought to be there, and I see them coming back, and then I see the birds that eat those insects coming back, and I can see the restoration of a thriving ecosystem just within 10 years, and actually a lot of it started coming back much earlier. So that's one of the reasons I wrote this book, is because I can see how quickly we really can make a difference. Is it as good as it was, in the beginning? No, but we have my last count was 103 species of woody plants on the property at this point, which is probably 75 species more than were there when we moved in. And all of the insects that use those species are coming back, and that gives you a variety of food for all of the birds. Every year we record new birds breeding at our property, and
wow.
we have a fox den in the front yard. I mean, these are fun things to watch. This is the first year we had turkeys come back, so I can see that this really does happen, and you don't have to have 10 acres for it to happen too. Even if you have a small lot, you can make a difference. There's an interesting story of a little 15 by 15 foot garden that employees at the Department of Ag building in Dover, Delaware planted a few years ago. They were actually putting in a garden to look at the native bees that still survived in Dover, Delaware. And this is in a courtyard, so it's surrounding by a building. And some of the plants they put in this little 15 by 15 foot garden were milkweeds. And one of the young ladies there decided she would count the number of monarch butterfly adults that went from egg to adult on those milkweeds in that little garden patch. The first year that they planted it, and it was 150. So that tiny little space really helped the monarch population in Dover, Delaware. And then they've been doing it every year since then. So don't give up on small spaces. They can be tremendously productive for our insect friends.
And I think especially people that are becoming interested in having a butterfly habitat
right.
as part of their garden, it also does help because you're attracting more pollinators, especially some of the prettier ones that people would like to see come into their garden. But it's just very interesting that, you know, you bring up the small little garden. I think a lot of people are starting to recognize that there is a very big need for the homeowner to take action and to plant certain types of plants that can be used as food sources for different species.
And of course, if you get your neighbors to do it too, then it's not so small. If you get your entire neighborhood to do it, it's not so small. You could have your entire neighborhood gardening for monarchs or gardening for tiger swallowtails or blue grosbeaks. I mean, the possibilities are endless. And then it becomes a uniting social adventure. You can all research on how to do this, and the kids can see when they first arrive. And that's the connection with nature that I would really like to see happen with all ages. And, of course, the more area you do this in, the more effective it's going to be.
Now, just out of curiosity, if a homeowner that happens to be tuning in today is planning for next year's garden mm-hmm. and they're inspired by your research to make some changes next year, what are some of the first things that you would recommend that are done to the land so that they can kind of get the ball rolling?
Well, that's a great question. If they are a typical homeowner, they have plenty of space for more trees. So the first thing I would do is get some more trees into your landscape. And I would build beds around those trees so that you're not mowing under them. That will reduce the amount of area that you have in lawn, so you can also add native viburnums and kalmia. There's endless number of shrubs. The understory trees, your shadbush, your serviceberry, native crab apples. There's all kinds of things that can be beautiful you can put into your yard that will get that plant biomass back into your yard. That's the most effective thing you can do. But really, before you do that, you want to come up with at least a general plan. Plan out those areas. Where do you want to maintain lawn? Where do you want to keep walking and keep mowing? Because if you have lawn, I do think you should keep it mowed. That's where it functions best, and it It convinces your neighbors that you really are landscaping. This is a planned activity, and you haven't abandoned the lot. That's not what we're trying to do here. But once you decide where you want your lawn, then start getting some of those trees into the landscape. This is a perfect time to plant oaks because the acorns are falling, and you can get it for free. And I know people say, "Oh, I can't put an acorn in. I won't live long enough to enjoy it." But I have white oaks all over my property that I planted from seed, from acorns, and they're now 16, 17 feet tall. So
wow.
It's been 11 years. But that time goes by fast these days. And even when they were small trees, they were supporting. They had structure for nests. I have pictures of sparrow nests in these trees, and they have Polyphemus moths on them, and the birds are eating them. So, if you want instant gratification, call your oak trees oak bushes, and then you've got it right away.
Well, one of the things that I noticed is that, especially in the suburbs, as people are cutting down trees, whether it's to put up a new home, make renovations on an existing home, or if they just feel that they don't want any damage that could come about from a tree that is getting very tall.
Right.
One of the things that I've personally noticed is that I have this huge population of wildlife that's in my own yard, and it's just amazing. If you just sit in the back, it's all the different animals that you can hear. It's just it's just really great. And
you can use your house as a blind. You know, when you're in your house and you look out your window, most of the things that are outside cannot look into your window, so they can't see you. And it's a perfect place to view wildlife. So if you have small trees by your house, like alternate leaf dogwood or serviceberry, right next to your windows, then you can see this bird sitting there right next to your window, and they become your pets. You get to know them, and we talk about interacting with nature, but don't think of doing that once a week or taking a field trip and taking a walk. You can do it 100 times a day when you bring it into your life in your lawn up close to the house, and it really gives you a warm and fuzzy feeling. It really makes you feel secure.
Now, there's a question that I have, and it's from one of the audience members. He would like to know, why is it that you don't see as many frogs as there used to be, especially in the New York metropolitan area?
Okay. There's several reasons. Frogs, of course, breed in waterways, so we have filled in a good many of our wetlands. But even where we have wetlands, I bet if you go out, if you're the average homeowner and you go out and you look in your window wells, chances are you will find a frog or several toads or skeletons of the frogs and toads that get stuck in the window wells. I looked in mine the other day. I mean, this is something that we're all guilty of. And at one time I pulled out, I think it was 9 toads and 3 frogs in a bucket and released them all. But you have to watch that because they get stuck in there. And then, of course, when we're mowing everything, those guys get chopped up. Or on these rainy nights when they're moving from pond to pond, they get squashed by our cars. So at almost every turn, we're killing these things. And then we say, wow, where'd they go? We make it really tough for them to get around and to survive.
So what's interesting is that you have people that say, well, you know, I don't want my lawn to get too high because then you're going to attract field mice and all sorts of other critters, so they just feel that, you know what, when it gets to a certain point, I want it chopped down, just so that they can minimize their exposure to some of these critters.
Right.
Not to mention the fact that, especially with the problems that we face with West Nile virus,
right.
Nobody wants water that's stagnant hanging around.
Right.
So,
well, okay, let's talk about mosquitoes. That's the reason you always hear for not having a little pond in your yard. But actually, mosquitoes don't do well in permanent water. It's not that they don't do well. It's just that their predators do well. So when the water never dries up, then you have all of the other insects that eat mosquitoes living in those ponds. And that goes for those polywogs and dragonfly nymphs and all of the predators, predaceous diving beetles. There are a number of aquatic predators that eat mosquito larvae. if the pond is allowed to dry up once or twice during the summer, that's what generates mosquitoes, because then all the predators leave, and then you get a rain, and either mosquitoes have laid their eggs on the mud and they just wait for the rain to come and they hatch, or they lay their eggs immediately when the water's there. But then the mosquitoes beat the predators back, and it's enough time to get a generation through, and that's when you get a lot of mosquitoes. So if you have drain pipes, you know, your gutters that get clogged are a perfect place for that to happen, because then they dry up and there are no predators left, or that tire in the back of your yard. So it's these temporary bodies of water that generate mosquitoes. And that's, you know, that's where the Asian tiger mosquito and all those guys that transmit West Nile virus live. But a permanent body of water that has frogs and toads and all of the aquatic predators and even fish in it is not going to generate very many mosquitoes at all.
Now, what about attracting certain types of birds? For example, we had a question from the audience. From Elizabeth, she'd like to know, how can I attract more hummingbirds through plant selection?
Okay.
Is there something that you can do?
Sure. Yeah, hummingbirds are an easy one. Hummingbirds need two things. Everybody thinks that all they need is sugar water because they're nectar feeders. And they are nectar feeders. They need a lot of nectar in order to generate the huge amount of energy they need to keep those little bodies going and flying at the amazing speeds that they do fly. But when they're nesting, of course, they feed their young insects and a lot of spiders. So you're not going to have hummingbirds around or they're not going to be nesting in your yard if you don't have enough insects to support them. If you want the hummingbirds to stop at your house when they're migrating, of course, a hummingbird feeder is a great way to do it. But I would recommend coral honeysuckle. That's our native honeysuckle with those nice bright red flowers. And red is attractive to hummingbirds. They're all over it. Put it in a prominent place so that you can see it outside your window. And it's sunny. You want a lot of sun for that. And they'll be loaded with flowers. My coral honeysuckle has flowers from May through November. I mean,
wow.
People talk about native plants not blooming very long. Well, that's a record. And hummingbirds will stop by that entire time period. Also, Campsis radicans, what's the common name of that? Trumpet creeper is great for hummingbirds. Crossvine is great for hummingbirds. Blue lobelia, there's so many native plants that hummingbirds depend on. In the spring, columbine, native columbines are perfect for hummingbirds. And actually, hummingbirds time their arrival as they move north with the blooming of columbines.
Interesting.
So you can get all those plants in your yard, and that will give them the nectar that they depend on. But don't forget the insects that the hummingbirds need.
Yeah. Well, it kind of makes sense that, you know, their migratory path coincides with these different plants that are flowering because
right.
It's their food. And it's just interesting how nature has its own little map.
Yep.
And all different species.
It all works.
Yeah, exactly. Another question that I have pertains to native grasses. I know that especially in certain protected areas where they are trying to protect the native grasses, it's a challenge because especially in certain areas, the grasses may be subjected to extreme inclement weather or just different predators that are just, you know, eating them down to the root. What do you recommend as far as trying to, I guess, reintroduce the native grasses into your own backyard?
Okay. Most of our native grasses, not all of them, but most of them are warm season grasses, which means they grow actively during the warm season, which is exactly the opposite of our typical lawns, which are cool season European grasses. They do well in the spring and the fall and don't grow, unless we water and fertilize them, they don't grow much during the summer. So our warm season native grasses are typically bunch grasses. They grow in clumps. And if you're trying to replace your lawn with native warm season grasses, you don't want to do it in an area where you want to mow and walk. You should keep those European grasses there because our native grasses are clumpy, and it doesn't want to be mowed during the growing season. That eventually will kill them. You want them to be able to grow. But they make these beautiful clumps, and in a typical eastern prairie situation, it leaves space between the grass clumps, and that is exactly what the animals, and particularly the birds that nest in our native grasses, want. So things like meadowlark, things like bobolink, the grasshopper sparrow, they need clumpy grasses in order to, you'd think they fly away, but they often run between around their nest and to escape predators. And if the grass is too dense, they can't do that, and they won't go into those areas. So how do you get those into your landscape? It really depends on how big an area you're trying to restore. If you have a large area and you're trying to turn it into a real eastern meadow, the best thing is to start from seed. There are excellent books that will walk you right through this. A new one by Catherine Zimmerman called The Urban Meadow. You can look that up. Will give you step by step on how to get a meadow into a suburban urban landscape. If you have a smaller area and you're trying to get some grasses into there, I would recommend going with plugs, because then it happens much faster. If you're starting from seed, people are often disappointed the first year because even though those grasses have germinated, they're extremely small. Mm. And it takes 3 years to get a functional meadow when you start from seed, where it's thriving and beautiful. And a lot of people don't want to wait that long. But if you start from plugs, it goes much faster. Of course, the downside is plugs are more expensive. And once you get them in the ground, you've got to water them. So getting a meadow started is actually one of the most challenging things that the native landscaper will undertake. Compared to planting a tree, which is easy. As long as you don't plant it too deep, that's the most common mistake people make. They dig that hole. They think a deeper hole is better, but it's not. A wider hole is better. You don't want the plant to sink down below its basal crown, or whatever they call that there, because then soil gets up against it, and that's the most common cause of death when you're transplanting a tree.
Yeah, it's interesting how if people sought out the advice and expertise from professionals that, they specialize in caring for these types of plants, they not only would be successful, but it would also save them a lot of money.
It just seems
to make sense that, you don't just find a plant in your local garden center or tree, shrub, what have you, and plop it in the ground, and then that's it. It's interesting that people are becoming more particular as far as the types of plants that they're planting, and it's good to see that there's more information out there as far as, if you do select this plant, what you can expect and how long it will take for it to really start to take off.
Right. A lot of people think that in order to get a big plant fast, you should plant a bigger plant, particularly with trees, and they'll spend a lot of money getting bigger trees. You can do that. There'll be a lot of nurseries very happy to sell you a large tree, but they're difficult to transplant, so installation is expensive. And the first thing they have to do is reestablish their root mass that was severed when they were transplanted. And they often just sit there for several years as they're building up roots. Whereas if you started with a much smaller tree, they build up the roots much faster. And in the end, it might be 5-7 years down the road, but in the end that smaller tree will actually grow faster and bigger than that big one that you put in. And you will save hundreds of dollars if you do that. So it's delaying gratification. In a way that will save you a lot of money, and you'll get to the same point in the long run.
But wouldn't a younger tree have a much stronger root system than if you were to take a more mature tree and transplant it?
Well, it's that the smaller the tree or the bush, the less damage has been done to the roots when it was transplanted. And of course, the ideal situation is start from seed. Then there's no damage to the roots.
Oh, of course.
The first thing a young oak tree does is put down this huge root system, and it doesn't grow much the first 2 years. But after that root system is down, then it takes off, and they grow much faster than you would think. But of course, they're healthier because they've never been shocked with transplant, and half the roots have ever been cut off, so they don't have to rebuild anything. That's the advantage they have.
Now, what about some of the other species as far as your yard? Do you think that it's better to get, say, a native blueberry bush as opposed to some type of particular variety that might yield, X number of pounds of berries? I'm just giving you a generic example. I mean, what are your feelings about native fruit trees?
I love them. You know, blueberries are very highly ranked plants, really productive. They have great fall color. They give you those berries. And they're productive in terms of supporting wildlife. I have blueberries in my yard, and we do get berries off of them, but we don't spray, and we lose some of the berries to the birds, and there are moth larvae that love blueberries, and they eat a lot of the leaves later on in the summer. Those are the types of things that if somebody's trying to maximize fruit production, they would go crazy over it. But those blueberries are doing a job for several organisms in my yard. I'm one of them, but the birds are another one. The Lepidoptera larvae are others, and so we're very happy with that relationship. If you're growing peaches or apples, there's no way you're going to get good peaches or apples without following all the regimen for producing those things, and that often includes frequent sprays. So that's a little bit different. You're producing food for yourself versus food for the food web in your yard. So you have to decide what your primary goal is when you're putting in these fruit trees. But
we have another question. This is coming from Facebook. George would like to know, isn't it true that the native species tend to thrive more than a plant that is not from that part of the region?
Right.
And also, don't they require less work?
Well, yes and no. If you think about it, the introduced invasive species like autumn olive, like porcelain berry, like multiflora rose, these things that have invaded our natural areas do really well. They grow really fast, they're highly competitive, and even though they're from someplace else, we can't argue that they're not doing as well as our native species. In fact, they're outcompeting our native species. So it's not a given that just because it's from someplace else, it's not gonna do well. On the other hand, it is very easy to get an ornamental plant from someplace else and try to force it into your local situation where it just doesn't want to be. So that's where that notion comes from. If you take a plant that really belongs there in the soil type and the shade and the water regime and the altitude and latitude and all that stuff, then it's going to do better than a plant that belongs in the Himalayas or something else. So that makes sense too. But the generality that native plants are always going to be hardier and do better than non-native plants is just not true. If that were true, we wouldn't have any invasive species at all. So less maintenance, it does depend on whether you put the right plant in the right place. If you have lawn, it's pretty easy to sit on a lawnmower and mow it. And if you have a lot of woody plants in your yard, particularly getting them established is a lot of work. I don't want to kid you about that. Once they're established, once you have those beds really well planted, then it is a lot less work. Because you don't have to mow that every week. But getting there can be a lot of work. A lot of people have particularly if they have any natural areas in their yard, they have lots of invasive species already. So first you have to get rid of those. That's a lot of work. So So, you know, good land stewardship and getting the land into a productive situation can be a lot of work, but it's really satisfying. You can make it a lifetime goal. You can say, I'm going to work on this little section this month, and you don't have to do it all at once. But anything you do, you're going to see positive effects from, and be happy that you did do it.
Thank you so much. And Dr. Tellamy, can you tell our audience about your website and how they can pick up a copy of your book?
Okay. The easiest way, well, you know, it's in your local bookstore, but, of course, it's also on Amazon.com. My website, the one that would give you the most information, is bringingnaturehome.net. So bringingnaturehome is all one word, and .net. On that website, if you follow the directions, you can come up with a ranking of all the woody plant genera in the mid-Atlantic states in terms of their ability to support food webs, from the best to the worst, and also all of the herbaceous plants from the best to the worst. And that can be important information if you're trying to restore a particular area.
And thank you so much for coming on the show today. It's been wonderful talking to you and also about your research. And I know, we have so many wonderful questions from the audience. And unfortunately, we can't have you on for the next 3 hours. But, folks, thank you so much for all the questions. And the book, Bringing Nature Home, it's really such a wonderful tool that you can use to introduce some of these species, just what they or how they coexist in your own home garden habitat. And it's just a great book for children and also for people who are avid gardeners or just people that are interested. It's just a wonderful book that should be part of anyone's collection, especially if you have a love of nature. But Dr. Tellamy, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. I really enjoyed the opportunity.
And folks, thank you so much for tuning in. This has been June Stoyer with your Organic View Radio Show. Have a great afternoon.